It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Farm to Table Talk ends up finding people that are in journeys of their own family and have found ways to bring food production or, you know, a farming or ranching into their lives in one way or another, and we cover lots of different approaches. One thing that is consistent is that I keep finding people that would like to stay connected with agriculture. They may have off-farm jobs, but many of them are talking about their dream is to be able to have something going on, whether it's cattle or hogs or it's farmers market kind of production. I'm talking to a couple today that's got an interesting journey underway with a young family, and they have found a way to be connected, to be able to raise some products. They still have other occupation too. But again, I think it's a journey that many people have these days, and I want to welcome Josh Eisen and Sarah Eisen, and welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thanks, Roger. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, and Sarah, kind of getting ready for this, you've managed to listen to some of my podcasts already, so you get an idea of what we're trying to find out is where people are on their journeys. Why don't you give us a little background of how you two found a connection and an interest in food and agriculture and in farming? Where to start?
So Josh and I do have an interesting background and a lot similar to a lot of people in agriculture starting out in 4-H. And that's where we really got kind of our passion and our drive and our work ethic of going out early in the morning, raising all different types of livestock, poultry, hogs, sheep, cattle at a really young age. And that's where we really just have that passion. And then as we started getting older, going off to school, we both pursued agricultural degrees at Morehead State University, and then later connected as a couple when I was finishing my master's in agriculture, and we both went to Texas Tech for our PhDs in animal science, food safety, and epidemiology.
So, Josh, did you grow up on a farm?
That's an interesting question, yes and no, in that we had a small 5-acre, you could call it a farm, more of a hobby farm, and we had livestock and that for 4-H only, because my parents both were off-the-farm jobs as well. My dad was a school teacher and my mom was a nurse, but my grandparents had a farm that it was eventually they had just rented the land for contract grain farming, but I was always connected that way and, you know, going and baling hay and helping out on other people's farms, so I'm kind of the newcomer to the industry, but you know, it's been very welcoming, and it's I absolutely love it.
So, how early how young were you when you got started? When you were going out to the farm, and you got some recollection of either working with the animals or baling hay or whatever?
Oh wow! The first I would say was, you know, you always get connected at the county fair. That's a good, you know, you remember those experiences and remember finding, connecting with people that had rabbits. And so then as I think I was, my parents could correct me, but 6 or 7, got my own rabbit. And then it just, you know, took off from there, so to speak. And I've been really addicted ever since. But then, you know, once I got in 4-H at, I think it's age of 9, then, you know, the projects took off from there.
Yeah, and that 4-H experience a lot of people have, and you had to keep records and you have to give reports and stand up in front of the club and give a talk and do demonstrations once a year. It's quite an experience. Sarah, did you have a similar start?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up kind of more on a farm of, it was still a hobby farm. It was never a full-time income for my parents, similar to the model what we're, Josh and I are personally doing as well, but we had around 100 acres, primarily horses, and did a lot of hay crop growing
up.
So
you're young kids, you're having a good time on the farms, you got some animals, you had an experience starting with 4-H, but somewhere along the line, you went to a high school guidance counselor, and they had I'm sure they were telling you, Sarah, you're doing really well, and we need to have you on this accelerated. You need to keep kind of taking these classes because, you know, probably at an early age, would it be right to say that both of you thought, well, college is in my future? And I suspect that guidance counselor said, okay, so what you need to do is grow up to be a farmer. Yeah, is that right?
So I think with my interactions with animals, for me, it was, I want to be a veterinarian. I want to care for animals. I love animals. How can I mold that into my everyday life and to have a career out of it? So for me, the direct path was as a veterinarian.
And Josh, how about you? What were you thinking about? Did you have animals in your mind when you were a kid and getting ready to go to college?
Actually, no. So I had always been very involved in sports as well. And so, you know, as every young teenage boy, they want to go play football at, you know, a big prestigious university. And that actually progressed. And I was recruited by a couple different universities, not big schools, but ended up somewhere along the lines. I was always looking back to what other options were there for school because of the need to find a career beyond sports. And luckily, Morehead State had agriculture, and that was something that had always been an idea for me, and was able to mesh the two together. So that's how I ended up there.
So is Morehead State, is where is that?
That's in actually Morehead, Kentucky, and it would be about 40 minutes east of Lexington.
Okay, okay. So you both end up there, and you both then get on a track of studying agriculture. And through that time, did you still have livestock back at home, or were you just studying it at that stage?
My parents did at that time start raising cattle. So we got cattle probably my freshman year of high school. And so they started really taking over that responsibility and having a cow-calf operation that they were growing at that time. But my focus at least was probably more on work at school and working with the animals that were actually at the farm at the university.
Now, as you're doing that, you pursue degrees, and you ended up getting three, basically. Mm-hmm. You got a bachelor's degree. You both got master's degrees. You both end up with PhDs. Now, did you interrupt that track, or did you keep going until you finished your PhD?
We both just were very fortunate and always take the opportunities that are in front of us. I don't think I ever had, when I was younger, saying, oh, I want to go get my doctorate or my PhD. I just looked at it as, what do I enjoy doing? And I would meet people that said, hey, they have a pretty cool job. And as I mentioned, I want to be a veterinarian, I started to kind of mold that in, what do I like about veterinary medicine? And I quickly learned that I like zoonotic diseases, so diseases that are passed from between animals and people. And how does that eventually relate to public health or human public health? So I took a couple internships working at some veterinary offices, some research labs up at Ohio State in zoonotic diseases. And that's how I got on the track of looking at Texas Tech for studying epidemiology and public health for food safety.
We ought to give a definition for epidemiology because it's hard enough to pronounce it. Population studies, right? You're looking at trends at large numbers of people.
Yeah, absolutely, Roger. So simply, it's just the study of disease on a population. And that population could be humans, it could be on dogs, it could be for what we worked on primarily in beef and dairy cattle. The diseases that we looked at primarily were Salmonella and E. coli.
Wow, that's very interesting. And Josh, how about you? What took you through all these steps to ending in a PhD?
Absolutely. So one of the things that was, I always come back to the people that are influencing you as a person that you don't realize it at the time. And I was very fortunate in that, was always surrounded by mentors and people that, you know, said, hey, what if you were to do this? Or, you know, you're really good at doing certain aspects of the current, you know, what you're doing right now. Here's where I see you're excelling. And, you know, really just like Sarah said as well, jumping at the opportunities as they go. And, I can think later on in our PhD career, a counselor that we had talked with several times in the grants and scholarship writing center. And she said, you know, I see how you really enjoy food safety and agriculture production, and I see how you can do this on a global scale and really focus on the international aspect of this. And literally at the time, I said, I don't think you're right. I want to go back home. And now it's so ironic that I work on a global scale in different countries all around the world on a daily basis.
Now we got to flash forward then to that, because you ended up, you know, completing your PhDs, and somewhere along that line, were you together already, or did you and then come back? Were you a couple when you were down there in Texas?
Our relationship did move pretty quickly. We moved to Texas together and worked for the same, got the opportunity to work for the same advisor, Dr. Guy Lonergan, which was an amazing experience to work hand in hand and go through a very high stress graduate program. And we got a couple opportunities while we were in Texas to also study abroad in France and working for their government entity and doing research for the United States over there. And when we finished up at Texas, we had had our daughter, Thea, and decided that, you know, what career are we going to go to, or where are we going to move to next? And we really had to reflect of, you know, what type of lifestyle do we want to have now for our daughter? And we wanted to have that career aspect, but we also knew we wanted her to have the opportunities of living on a farm like we did. And so that's when we said, all right, no careers right now. We're just going to move back to Ohio and let's make this happen.
You know, Josh, I hear other people telling stories just like Sarah just did, that felt like there was a point in their life where, of all these other considerations, family was part of it too, and they wanted their kids to be able to have an experience of being outdoors or having the responsibility of raising some livestock. You had that opportunity, but you also got another job. I mean, like you were saying, sure. You each are able to pursue careers that you wouldn't have to be raising livestock. You've got a day job. Sarah, you're doing consulting as well. At what point did you say, okay, now we're going to add this enterprise. We're going to not only pursue these jobs that we're pursuing, but what you really want to do is raise, in your case, grass-fed beef. Did a light bulb go off, or was that in the back of your mind every step of the way then when you loaded the U-Haul up in Texas?
So I think it's a combination of both. So we had always talked about, wouldn't it be great if we could move back to the farm to be closer to family, to be closer to what we enjoy doing. And, you know, once we had our daughter, it was very much so of, you know, we have very strong connections with our parents and our grandparents as well. And we wanted to provide our daughter that opportunity to get to know those people and let them be influential in their in her life. And like Sarah said, we really did just decide, let's move home and we have to give it a try. If you want to do something in life, you might as well go after it. The worst thing that you can do is fail, and then you look for opportunities elsewhere. So we actually gave ourselves 6 months after we moved home. Said, we are going to find, you know, make it work here and find jobs, or then we'll start looking elsewhere. And I kid you not, at 5.5 months, the job posting for my current role popped up, and it was just, you know, the greatest feeling in the world. And then the next feeling is, I better get that. I better show and prove that this is who I am and this is what I want to do, or else, you know, we are going to lose the current situation. And so, you know, I guess we are both a example of, yes, you can have your cake and eat it too. We are, you know, have our jobs and careers off the farm, that we're very connected to agriculture as a whole, but then we're also allowed to go out on a daily basis and go, you know, check our cows and take our kids with us. So it's,
you get to, but you also are raising a couple of young children, and you've also got other clients in your case, and you've got a job. You've had to do a little head scratching and saying, what, we're going to add a cow herd, and then we got to have a marketing plan. And after the kids go to bed, were you sitting around at the kitchen table and trying to whiteboard your ideas or what?
Yeah, absolutely. So a big part of coming back to a family operation is how do you make a niche for you to grow the farm? So my parents already had an established cow-calf herd. So the mama cows and the baby cows that they would sell when the calves got old enough, they would sell those at the stock market. And so I would be able to, okay, well, we're really close to Cincinnati. How can I use this as our benefit? So I began thinking of, you know, direct marketing as the farm to table aspect, and that movement is growing, I think, even more. And I was like, hey, this is how we can become part of the family farm, and I can expand that. So I would begin taking the calves, and I'd purchase them from my dad, and then Josh and I would put them into our program for later direct marketing that beef directly to consumers in Cincinnati.
So Josh, you weren't cow-calf, you were buying the calves. Right.
Right. Well, and we were involved with helping and, you know, being part of the cow-calf operation. And I think Sarah's dad, Jamie, has been very good at allowing us to make decisions and help that ultimately it's going to lead to how we market and the product that we can provide. And so I'm sure that several years down past, he had already had this in mind of, well, we have the cows and the calves, and just based on the experience that Sarah and I have of wanting to feed cattle, he probably knew that this was coming eventually. And so just, you know, it's been a very good addition to the farm. And what is really good about it as well is that we can capture the income that her parents had already established for the cow-calf operation, but then we can take their product and turn it into ours and capture income on that side of it. So we're not robbing one part of the operation to pay for another.
And Sarah, these cattle are your Angus cattle, and almost everybody listening to this would know Angus are the black cattle, but they're Angus cattle. But when you talk about finishing them, taking them from calves, is it largely fed on grass? What are you feeding them?
So our calves, after weaning, pretty much all of our cattle are out on pasture 100% of the time, especially during the spring through the summer and late fall. So we say even our beef cows, the ones that we're raising to that will go for processing and that we'll market and sell, everything is on pasture 100% of the time. Our beef cows also get a free choice access to a grain ration. So this grain ration we source either by growing ourselves, the soybeans or the corn, or purchasing them from a neighbor. And then Josh balances a feed ration to provide them all of the essential vitamins and minerals that they need to keep them healthy.
Now, then you made a decision. I mean, you are incorporating grain. There are some people that part of their whole plan from the outset is to be just grass-fed. And yours is not just grass-fed. I mean, it's local. There's a lot to be said about your system. Why not? Why is it that grain's part of your plan?
Well, I think it all comes back to you have to do what works best for you. And the situation, the way the farm is laid out, we have plenty of ground, but we also wanted to utilize some of the other resources that are available to us. And it worked in the system where, yes, we can have a rotational grazing system most of the year, but based on the weather patterns in Ohio and that, at certain points of the year, you have to feed hay. And, well, if you're going to go ahead and feed hay, you also have the opportunity to feed other products that can help, you know, the cattle with an energy source, or, you know, we're very deficient in some essential minerals, so we supplement them that way. And then it just kind of changed a little bit to now we are proud to say we're partnering with a local brewery just right down the street here and feeding some spent grains that would either be sent to a dump or gone into some other practice of, you know, composting first. So we like to say that we are upcycling those nutrients back into the beef cattle, and then it's working as, you know, eventually becomes fertilizer on our pastures as the cows move around and spread that for us.
That's interesting. Now, Do you run into, as you market the product, do you run into people that you have to explain to them why you're not simply grass-fed? Because some people have heard a lot about that. And do you find that when you are in a farmer's market, I'm jumping ahead, and we're going to talk about that because you're a marketing product at a farmer's market, do you find those questions come up with some of the people that are buying your beef?
Absolutely. So I think it's really, I love when customers ask questions because that shows that they really do care, and it's a priority to them to know how their animals are cared for, how they're raised, where does their food come from. So I get every type of question of, some people do want straight grass-fed cows, and that's perfectly fine. And I know our product isn't for everyone. But what I do know is when we have those conversations with customers of why we implement certain feed into providing it for our cows, that most of the time consumers are completely open to hearing that and then trying our product. So we talk to them about the humane handling for cattle and what we do from a beef quality assurance standpoint to ensure that their animals are raised with the best care, and that our priority is to provide them the highest quality nutrition to meet their needs.
So in addition to raising the cattle, I want to come back and have you put your epidemiology hat on.
That was right.
And because there have been a great deal of concern about antibiotic-resistant bacterias. And do you run into people that are challenged by that? And how do you answer those questions when people are fearful that there's going to be antibiotic resistance and there may be too many antibiotics in the foods that they're consuming now?
So antibiotic resistance, especially in beef cattle and in dairy cattle, is actually where I did focus for my PhD work. And antibiotic resistance is not a new phenomenon. It's been around for millions of years. Bacteria naturally have resistance to certain antibiotics, to certain classes of antibiotics.
So there are some natural antibiotics.
Absolutely, yeah. But as the first use of penicillinases became on the market, we started to see an overuse of antibiotics, both in human medicine and in animal production systems. The FDA and the USDA, along with the World Health Organization, created a list of critically important antibiotics that are important for human medicine. And those antibiotics have been removed from animal production systems completely. On our operation, we will never say we'll never use antibiotics because we always want to divert back to animal welfare. If we have a sick cow, which is very, very, very uncommon, we're going to treat them. We want them to be healthy. So we want to make sure that we work really closely with our veterinarian to ensure that we're choosing the correct antibiotic for the correct symptoms that the cow is having.
Now, at one stage, though, some other commodities in particular put low levels of antibiotic in the feed just routinely, and with the assumption, and evidently a proven assumption, that it might help gains. Whether or not they were sick. Josh, is that an area where a lot of these problems developed because of that routine kind of low-level feeding of antibiotics?
That's a really good question. And I would say as a short answer, yes and no. And really what I would say the focus is, those antibiotics that are used at the low levels are actually not used for growth promotion anymore. And in certain cases, that's what I do, probiotics. But the...
You have probiotics for cattle?
Oh, yes, definitely.
We'll get to that.
We will. That's always on my mind, so that's why it naturally just comes out. But the AGPs, the antibiotic growth promoters, most of those were not necessarily antibiotics even used in human medicine, and they were targeted at very specific chronic or different aspects of animal feeding. So, for instance, ionophores are used in cattle production, and one of the big considerations for that was liver abscesses. And so using a certain antibiotic, well, it's technically an antibiotic, but it's not even used in human medicine. And we've seen through the use of that a overall benefit to the industry of adding usable edible protein back into the food supply that would have been condemned because of liver abscesses and that.
you said something that I can't let get by me here, and that's probiotics. So I've got this envisioning that you're feeding these calves kombucha or something.
It's a little yogurt, right. It's a little more sophisticated than that. But yes, it is a fermented material that it just so happens to be a very specific or a combination of strains that have been researched and vetted for specific characteristics. So I work for a biotechnology company called BioWish Technologies, and we have specific microbial-based products for agriculture as well as animal feeding and environmental management industries. And I work in the animal health nutrition aspect of that, and that covers a wide range of animals, of poultry, swine, beef, dairy, as well as aquaculture. And we have specific in-feed probiotics as well as products that contain probiotic bacteria for improving the environmental conditions around livestock production. So we're trying to do a multi-hurdle approach of affecting the animal's gut and promoting gut health as well as feeding efficiency and more of like an insurance policy towards helping with any pathogen insults, as well as working on cleaning up the environment and combating potentially harmful bacteria that are commonly associated with those production environments.
Interesting. I mean, for the most part, I mean, when you talk about microbial, which is, again, a word the average person doesn't use a lot, but it's bacteria that you need in your gut. And I'm reminded of hearing a story about removing all the contents of the intestines of an obese mouse and putting them in a skinny mouse, and they just swapped them. They swapped the gut content, and the obese mouse got skinny, and the skinny mouse got fat, and they were getting fed exactly the same thing, and it was totally from the gut that had that effect. And so, you know, it's quite a frontier of what the implications are. I mean, obviously, I see that it's good, that it might raise beef better, livestock better, but certainly has implications for humans as well, too. Absolutely. Yeah. Epidemiology, though, hasn't a lot to draw from on gut health. I mean, when you were studying epidemiology and you could see correlations maybe between what people were eating and different health effects, it's pretty hard to probe on how much probiotics are into the diets, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So trying to, I think that's the biggest thing, is determining what is actually that causal agent and what might be modifying some of the observations or the effects that we're seeing. So if we're feeding a group of cattle a probiotic, how is that going to affect their overall performance? How is it going to affect their overall ability to digest the feed that they are taking in and then utilize it?
Yeah. And then I wonder whether there's certain probiotic qualities in that feed that you're getting from the breweries with some of that spent grain. I want to believe that.
Yeah. And we're still supplementing, even with the spent grain. I'm sure there's some bacteria that was naturally present probably on the grain, just from the soil bacteria. But we also do supplement them with the probiotic strains that BioWish produces that have been specifically selected and that know that they work well in cattle.
Well, let's bring this back to the cattle. So the two of you have got all these other things you're doing, plus raising two kids. How do you do that? I mean, you've got Angus cattle in a pasture someplace. And so when do you do your chores? And when are you out there feeding them and checking them and taking care of the kids and all the other things you do in life?
Sure. That's a great question. It's all the time. It's a job that's, you know, constantly the cows need to be fed at a certain time, or if they get out, we need to ensure that we get them back into the fence. And, you know, it takes a village to raise the kids. And so luckily we are very blessed that we have grandparents that we can count on to help us and be there for us with the kids. But we like to take them with us and incorporate them into the operation as, you know, as long as it's safe.
So they're riding around in the pickup while you're kicking hay off in the winter.
Right, exactly. And, you know, that's important to us to be able to bring the kids along so they can experience it just like we did when we were younger. And it's really nice that we do have help, but we're also starting to introduce other technologies that can eventually help us even further. So we just installed a camera system that we can look at different areas of the farm to make sure things are okay. And then recently, Sarah let me buy a drone. And
all right.
Yeah, I'm still an amateur.
And they should go to your website because you get good drone shots. So that if people want to go, give them the website address right now.
Yeah, the website is www.cincybeef.com. And Cincy is spelled CincyBeef.
I think that it's a great shot because they're going over and you see the rolling hills. And now, when you're raising these cattle, when are they ready to be processed? What weights? 1,000 pounds or what?
Right now, based on the frame size of the cattle we have, we are actually targeting right around 1,300 to 1,350, just because we know that that gives the best yield for the inputs that we have.
They didn't used to make Angus that big.
Right. The belt buckle cattle back in the day that were a lot shorter. And and so a lot of people, when we tell them what weight we're finishing them to, they are taken aback because typically, historically, it's been a 900-pound animal that would be sent to the slaughterhouse. But we, through selecting certain genetics from seed stock producers, we've looked at what cattle work best in our area that eventually provide the best end user product. So we look at the EPDs that give us the quality pounds of carcass for all of the inputs that we're using.
Sarah, one of the reasons that people don't raise more more livestock, even as if it's a part-time venture that they've got off-farm jobs and other things, one of the big problems they run into is marketing. Now, at one point where I met you, where you were actually set up at the Marymount, Ohio Farmers Market, and so there's a share of what you're doing. It's going there. So how much of your product is ultimately going through like a farmer's market or our website sales? What's the mix of where your beef ends up being sold?
So marketing has definitely been a new venture for me to do. I would probably say if I had to go back through all my education and coursework at all the universities I attended, I would definitely have taken a marketing or a business class at some point. So learning how to identify your markets that you can sell to, identify who your customers are, being able to tell the story of what type of product you're selling. So I believe that right now about 60% of the beef that we're raising, I'm selling as bulk orders to, so quarters, halves, wholes directly to families so they can stock up their freezers, have beef all year round. And then the other 40% I sell directly, primarily through the farmers market like Marymount. I do a couple other markets around Cincinnati, the off market in Oakley and the west side market in Cheviot, where I sell directly. They're kind of a farmers market setup once a month. They're on Marymount. It's every Sunday. And that's where the other 40% goes. And then that's also split between my website sales. So I'll just sell directly through the website where people can either come and pick it up at the farm or I can ship it as well.
You know, when you process cattle, there's more than T-bones. And so when you end up having, well, say, for example, the hides, I mean, what happens with all of that, the byproducts, other than just the meat items that you're able to sell online or at the farmer's market?
And that's, so everybody wants a good steak, a good ribeye steak. So it is a big challenge to balance that out because you get about 50 to 55% of your final meat product is ground beef. And finding an avenue to sell that to so you don't sell out all of your ribeyes. We're working to try to utilize as much of the animal as possible. Some of the organ meat, the more creative cuts of the tongue or the heart, and finding some of the more groups of different ethnicities that want to incorporate that back into their normal diet. So finding those groups of individuals and customers to take those types of products to. Unfortunately, at this time, we have not found a market for our hide. Our processor that we use is has another outlet that they sell those to.
You know, one thing I'm finding around the country is that the different ethnic groups that have a habit before they came to the States of consuming products we don't normally do, those markets are popping up, but they're popping up in places that we're just not used to serving. And that gets back, I think, to your choice of processing. I mean, it used to be you could take your beef to the stockyards and some major packer would buy it. And you actually are using a USDA-inspected plant in Kentucky, which people that don't know, it's pretty close to here, just across the river. But still, why can't you process at a non-USDA plant? There still are locker plants around. Wouldn't it be easier to use something that's not a USDA plant?
We're always going to go back to the food safety aspect of it. So in their facility that we use, we selected it because it's a relatively new facility. All of their employees go through special certification training to make sure when they're handling even the live animals that they're handling them in the most humane way possible. And I think that's one of probably the bigger differences under that regulation and inspection. Even as a live animal that's coming into their plant, we know that they're still receiving the best care possible and handled that way. We want to make sure that the meat is always kept at a proper temperature when it's being fabricated. And it's always cooled and then immediately flash frozen to ensure the food safety aspect of the meat.
If you could be sure of that and it wasn't a USDA plant and it's just here in the state of Ohio, would you be allowed to sell the beef online or to sell the beef at a farmer's market or to a restaurant, even though it wasn't USDA inspected?
Yeah, so in Ohio, we also have Ohio Department of Agriculture inspection facilities. There are regulations as far as only being able to sell ODA inspected meat in Ohio or across state lines with partnerships in Kentucky or Indiana, but we would not be able to ship to Texas to some of our customers that way.
It's something I think a lot of people are still discovering. I'm wondering, if there's somebody listening to this and say it's a couple like yourselves that have got an education, have got other careers, you've got a family started, but you wanted to be able to have livestock as a part of it. What advice would you have to somebody that says, I wish I could do this. I wish I could add a livestock enterprise that in addition to my day job, I could work all the time and work, you know, outside and raise livestock and have something, maybe farmers market and so forth. Any suggestions you have for somebody that's scratching their head and thinking, I'd want to be like you?
Oh, absolutely. So there are a couple different ways you could go about that. And one of the easiest ways would probably find a producer that's relatively close to you and create a connection and a relationship with them and learn by doing and help and see what you can add or help the producer with and potentially look at how you can, you know, eventually branch out on your own. There are also other government programs or funds available potentially for like they call it young and beginning farmers, where there is money set aside to potentially help with the initial input costs of startup, which can be very, very high depending on the livestock and the scale and complexity of the operation you have in mind. But I would just say, from the bottom of my heart, know that it is possible. And if you want to get involved in agriculture, there are plenty of ways and opportunities that you could do so.
Sarah, to add to that, any precautions you have for them? I mean, I like this, what Josh is saying, is being optimistic, you know, that there's a way to do it. Are there things, especially, again, I keep coming back to the fact that your epidemiology studies and so forth, that food safety and other issues are... What are some of the caveats you have in your mind that if you move ahead, these are important things to keep in mind?
So, for instance, direct marketing our product at a farmer's market, I have to have a specific license through our county health department to make sure that my meat's transported correctly. So contacting your public health department, see what they require to transport meat. Our county, for instance, in Claremont, we have to have the meat under complete electronic cooled temperatures all the time. So making sure you're asking the right questions to be legally regulated, having liability insurance to cover you in case there ever was which would be very uncommon, but something happened or somebody get sick from your raw product. I always try to share cooking, proper cooking and handling instructions for our raw meat products and regulation that way. And just to kind of mimic Josh, just ask questions. We've got a lot of your local extension offices are a great resource to get started. Your county public health department, your local county farm bureau office. I do a lot of work now with the Ohio Farm Bureau and American Farm Bureau, and they have a lot of resources to help you get started looking for funding opportunities to see maybe what type of commodities are people looking for in your area and how can you maybe fill a niche market that isn't being met by another producer.
Well, it's interesting, it's exciting what you're doing, and I hope people, when they find you at the farmer's market or online, they have any questions, they ask you questions, because I would imagine that you hardly ever run into something that you can't satisfy the concern if they just talk to you. So it's a consumer getting to know their farmer.
Yeah, and I say absolutely. At the end of the day, I always invite people to come out and to see the farm. If they have questions about how we're feeding our cattle or raising them, we say, hey, come on out and see what we do.
So again, I'm going to go back and have you mention your website again, because they can see them a little bit from the drone that Josh talked you into now, that looking at the cattle. And if they can also find out how to contact you, right?
It's cincybeef.com, so CincyBeef.com. And you can also find us on all the social media outlets.
So I'm suspecting that if I come back and we do this again in 7 or 8 years, your kids are going to be showing cattle at the county fair, right? Is that part of the experience you expect them to have in front of them?
Well, we're not going to push them into it, but they have already expressed that they are very interested and in love being around the cows, and they have already picked out which cow is theirs. So, for instance, our daughter Thea, her cow is named Radiance. And I think at some point, if that were a possibility, she would love to take Radiance to the fair and show her off to all of her friends. So we have a few years yet to get prepared for that, but I think that's a pretty big possibility.
Sarah, it's a nice vision. Any final comments you'd have, any other suggestions to people and how you either view your journey or suggestions for them?
I think the big thing is just ask questions. Find somebody that, you know, is maybe doing something similar to what you're think you might want to be doing. See if that's the road that you want to go down. Find a group of individuals that can support you on the journey, because it's not easy. It's not easy to be a mom and to have an off-farm job and to have the farm all the time, but to have a community of individuals that support you, I think is the best way to make it work.
Sounds like a good way to me. And Josh and Sarah Eisen, I really appreciate your being on Farm to Table Talk.
Thanks, Roger. Thanks for having us. This has been very fun.
Yeah, and I'm wonderful and blessed that you ran into us at Marymount.
I am too.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.